The world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. My name is Laura Lanting, and I homeschool our three children. We live in Flagstaff, Arizona, where the recent tunnel and pipeline fires devastated part of our town and forest, and is now causing intense flooding from these burn scars. My husband is a civil engineer and is working on flood mediation of the museum fire of 2019 as well. We thank you for your prayers for the Southwest. We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Pro-life businesses are feeling the heat over their support for life. Protesters are finding creative ways to make life difficult for them.
That's ahead. Also, legal analysis of last week's raid of former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. Plus, we're headed back to the moon. Well, we're not, but NASA is, and World's Bonnie Pritchett visits the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, meeting some of the people behind the mission.
Artemis 1 is a stack of hardware and a mission and an idea, but it takes people to make those things happen, and I'm...
And Cal Thomas on what's troubling public schools.
It's Thursday, August 18th. This is The World and Everything in It, from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Paul Buck.
Up next, Ken Covington with today's news.
Migrants continue to arrive at the U.S. southern border in staggering numbers. The Border Patrol now reports nearly 200,000 migrant encounters in July, and through fiscal year 2022, that number is almost 2 million. The mayor of Rio Grande City, Texas, Joel Villarreal, is calling on the federal government to step up.
I don't have the financial resources to be able to sustain the number of influx of immigrants coming through.
Of the migrants who crossed the border last month, two-thirds were single adults. Most were given court dates and released inside the United States. Meantime, New York City Mayor Eric Adams is calling Texas Governor Greg Abbott morally corrupt for busing migrants from Texas to his city and to Washington, D.C. He's accused the governor of mistreating migrants.
Any adult or child, those are horrific conditions that place human beings under.
But Texas authorities pushed back. They said they load the buses with plenty of food and supplies, and everyone is treated humanely. Adams has complained that the influx of hundreds of migrants has overwhelmed homeless shelters in his city. But Governor Abbott said that is a tiny fraction of the challenges facing his state.
It is now time for states like New York and cities like New York City to begin to shoulder some of that burden.
The New York Post reports that the city may soon convert a swanky Times Square hotel into an intake center for migrants. A federal judge says several major pharmacy chains played a role in the opioid crisis and must pay hundreds of millions of dollars in damages. World's Kristen Flavin has more.
U.S. District Judge Dan Polster in Cleveland awarded $650 million in damages Wednesday to two Ohio counties. It's part of a lawsuit that claimed that the way CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart distributed opioids to customers caused severe harm to communities. A jury returned a verdict in November in favor of the counties. It was then left to the judge to decide how much the counties should receive in damages. The pharmacy chains argued that it was doctors who controlled how many pills were prescribed, not their pharmacies. And they said they had policies in place to notify authorities about suspicious orders from doctors. The companies plan to appeal the ruling. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
Former New York City mayor and Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani answered questions before a grand jury in Atlanta Wednesday. It's part of an investigation by Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis. The probe centers on whether former President Donald Trump and others may have interfered in Georgia's 2020 election, putting pressure on election officials. Giuliani told reporters outside the courthouse,
"I'll talk about this until it's over. It's a grand jury, and grand juries, as I recall, a secret."
Giuliani provided legal representation to Trump and his campaign. Fannie Willis said she's also considering calling Trump himself to testify. The former president maintains he did nothing improper. Turkey and Israel are patching things up diplomatically. World's Anna Johansson Brown has that story.
The two countries have resumed full diplomatic relations. Both nations recalled their respective ambassadors in 2010 after an incident involving Israeli forces that resulted in the deaths of nine Turkish activists. In 2018, following an attempt to mend ties, Turkey again recalled its ambassador after the U.S. opened an embassy in Jerusalem. Now, the two sides are hitting the reset button again. Earlier this year, Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid visited Ankara in June. That came a month after his Turkish counterpart visited Jerusalem, the first high-level visit by a Turkish official in 15 years. Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson-Brown.
Planned Parenthood plans to spend a record $50 million to sway voters ahead of November's midterm elections. This tops the $45 million the group pumped into 2020 campaigns. The money will pay for door knockers, phone calls, and advertising. Planned Parenthood will spend most of that cash in nine states where pro-life laws or candidates may feature prominently on ballots. I'm Kent Covington, and still ahead, legal analysis of the FBI's Mar-a-Lago raid, plus preparing to go back to the moon. This is The World and Everything in It. It's Thursday, the 18th of August, 2022. We're glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Paul Butler.
And I'm Myrna Brown. First up on The World and Everything in It, pro-life businesses face backlash. Since the Supreme Court released its opinion overturning Roe v. Wade, pro-life businesses have been under attack. But not necessarily in the way you might think.
Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh was forced to flee his dinner without dessert, mind you, after a group of pro-choice protesters approached the Morton's Steakhouse that he was eating at.
That's the Young Turk describing the scene at a Washington, D.C. restaurant last month. What's really important, though, is what happened to Morton's after those protesters left. It got swamped with negative reviews on Yelp and Google. Not about the food or the restaurant quality, rather about abortion. Eventually, the steakhouse's parent company got Yelp and Google to take down the political reviews.
But then protesters changed tactics. Thousands of fake reservations flooded Morton's system until they put in a credit card requirement for each reservation. Well, here to talk about incidents like this, our world's Carolina Lumetta and Josh Schumacher. Hey, you guys. Well, we're delighted to have you with us.
We're delighted to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So you two wrote a piece in the latest issue of World Magazine about pro-life business owners facing off against malicious spammers. Tell us about what's going on here.
Right. So what we found is that online activists are really creating major headaches for pro-life groups. We've seen some activist groups design an easily downloadable algorithm that can blast fake online reviews of a crisis pregnancy center every 20 seconds. The same concept is now being applied to restaurants like Morton's Steakhouse and other businesses that have nothing to do with abortion or religion. They're just owned by or simply host people with pro-life beliefs. And Josh actually got the chance to talk to one business owner who's been dealing with this.
Yeah, so I got to speak with John Lillis, who is the skipper, awesome title, of Lifeboat Coffee in Phoenix, Arizona. Here's what he had to say.
Immediately after Dobbs, people that had followed me on Instagram and Facebook Business and Twitter were like, literally, F you, you know, you're stupid, you hate women. I'm like, well, have you not been paying attention for the last 8.5, 9 years? Like, literally, nothing's changed, right?
So basically, he's gotten a bunch of online spam, and he hasn't really changed anything at all about what he or his business are doing. He's just kind of paying the price, really, of being pro-life in a post-Dobbs world.
Right, right. Here's what I'm wondering. Aren't these kinds of digital protests preferable to in-person ones? I mean, you know, if you're a business owner, wouldn't you rather receive virtual criticism than actual disruptions to your work, you know, face-to-face kind of thing?
So think back to the protests of the 60s, the lunch counter sit-ins and the bus rides. These were more localized protests and in-person events focusing on specific highways or a Woolworth's lunch counter. But today, all anyone really needs to protest is an internet connection. people thousands of miles away from that steakhouse here in DC can do their bit just by posting as if they've been a customer there. And they know it's an effective strategy because businesses, especially now, depend on online traffic and reviews. And this negative online attention hits small businesses much harder when they lose customers over it.
And it's important to note as well that, like Carolina said, this negative attention online is not happening in a vacuum. In some cases, it's also coming with very real in-person damages to property or protests. John Lillis actually shared one story with me that I think kind of epitomizes what pro-life businesses are having to go through outside of the digital front.
Now, my roastery cafe is not in the best neighborhood in Arizona, but somebody threw a rock through the window and, you know, it's like $1,000 window, right? So I looked at the video feed and I said to my friends, look, if it's a zombie or a neighborhood homeless guy, some drug guy, I don't care. You know, that stuff's going to happen. But it was some young dude, man bun, little white backpack, nice kids, you know, like clearly it was not a random act of violence or vandalism.
So were business owners willing to talk to you guys about this for the most part?
For the most part, no, actually. They weren't because they're concerned for their safety. A lot of business owners were worried that people might read our article on it and target them all over again with maybe more rocks through windows. A lot of them have continued to receive threatening emails and phone calls. One small business said they're just trying to move on and protect their employees. And another completely deleted all their social media platforms, which is really detrimental to a small business, but they said it's trying to stay safe.
Yeah, part of the reason I would imagine that John Lillis was willing to talk to us is, well, for one, he's just not a fearful guy. But for another, the point of his business is being pro-life. And that's something that he's been ever since he started, or his business has been ever since he started it 10 years ago. And, you know, a lot of these businesses, they're not pro-life. They're not pro-choice. They're not really like either going either way. I mean, you know, the owner might have a preference or they might have liked a comment on Instagram or something like that. But a lot of these businesses, you know, this is something that's kind of striking them out of the blue. John Lillis, in a way, is kind of prepared for this and is able to expect it, sort of.
Mm-hmm. One more question, Josh, about Mr. Lillis. Has he taken any safety measures or anything after someone's thrown a brick through his window?
Well, sort of. I'll go ahead and let him tell you.
This is Arizona, though, so you may not know this, but it's a constitutional carry state, so I carry two guns at all times, and I'm military trained, so I'm like, kids, it's perfectly safe. You have nothing to worry about here in Arizona. But so, I mean, it didn't have that big of an impact.
But see, despite this, his two teenage daughters, who used to help out around the coffee shop, sort of like baristas, they'd help with making coffee drinks or they'd help with cleaning things up, they don't want to come by anymore. And his wife has also stopped the rest of their children from dropping by the coffee shop as well.
Yeah, that's a tough situation for sure. Well, thank you guys so much for talking with us. This has been very helpful.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for chatting.
And to read more about this situation, check out Carolina and Josh's story in the latest issue of World Magazine. We've included a link in today's transcript.
Up next, a legal look at the FBI's Trump investigation. The Justice Department is resisting calls to release the affidavit that supported the search warrant used for the FBI search of Donald Trump's Florida estate. They say that to do so would reveal highly classified material and other information that could irreparably damage an ongoing criminal investigation. The former president, for his part, is accusing the FBI of partisan political corruption. He's also calling on the Bureau to return some of the documents they seized, saying they're protected under attorney-client privilege.
Last week, we spoke with Mark Caleb Smith about the political backdrop of the Mar-a-Lago search. This week, another Cedarville University professor, Mark Clausen, is here to analyze the case from a legal perspective. He is a professor of history and law. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Professor, This is a politically charged case, but it's also legally complex. A court has unsealed the search warrant, but not the affidavit. What's the difference between those documents?
Yeah, the difference partly, they all go back to the Fourth Amendment. We have to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, secure in our houses and papers and effects, and issues like that in the Fourth Amendment. But out of that flows sort of a several-step process. One of those things is you apply for the warrant, you get the warrant, you also have an affidavit with the warrant that goes mm-hmm. along with the warrant. Now, the warrant itself specifies the particular legal provisions under which you're moving forward, and also what you want to seize or look at in a particular location. The affidavit is much more specific. It deals with the actual legal theories, who may have been a witness in this, may list witnesses. It may deal with what exactly, in more detail, what they think they found or want to find, and who told them. So that is a much more sensitive document, it's true. And in many criminal cases, at least, it's not something that the prosecutor or the prosecution, in this case the Justice Department, wants to release because there are situations in which there can be witnesses compromised or you can discourage witnesses to come forward. This doesn't look to be the same kind of case precisely, not the same level at least. Mm-hmm. So that's why this one's a little iffier, to be honest with you, although we don't know the details, and that's the problem.
Yeah. When we talk about evidence, what kinds of evidence might the Bureau have to produce to get a search warrant? I mean, you know, what's the bar there that they have to clear?
It doesn't have to have the evidence at first. It has to have a probable cause that it will find the evidence. So apparently, from what we know, and we don't know everything, mm-hmm. but from informants or witnesses who've come to the FBI have said, you know, he's got these things, papers in his house at Mar-a-Lago, and they may be sensitive, or they are sensitive. Maybe somebody said that. And so they go to the magistrate judge. They say, okay, here's what we think we're going to find. Here are the statutes that we think he's violated if he has those. And that's it. There's no actual evidence yet until they go get it. Then they start to find out what it is.
Mm-hmm. It was originally thought that the FBI's search centered on the Presidential Records Act, but the warrant revealed he's actually under investigation for potential obstruction of justice and Espionage Act violations. So what's the distinction there, and what's the significance?
Well, for one thing, you have to say that you don't know whether any of these kinds of statutory provisions will stick. Oftentimes, the justice agency will simply throw a bunch of statutes in that they think would cover the particular issue that they're interested in. Mm-hmm. They don't really know whether any of that's going to work or not. So Espionage Act, how do you deal with that one? This requires an intent to do something wrong with a record in a particular way that would compromise the security of the United States. I don't think they really knew whether that's what they would find there. They're going on a hunch or an informant's hunch. And they're not sure. But that's a more serious charge. There's no doubt about it. Obstruction of justice is also a serious charge that usually goes along with an other charge like Espionage Act or presidential papers, statutes, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So you obstruct the Justice Department from getting those papers that you think you should have had or the National Archives should have had. So, it's a serious charge, but we don't know whether that charge will hold up or not.
An authorized Trump representative to the National Archives claimed that Trump issued a standing order that all documents he removed were deemed to be declassified. Mm-hmm. Does the president have that power? And if he does, how does it work?
The president has that authority, but there are procedures he has to go through. Now, I will say, in this case, we need to see the actual documentary evidence that he went through those procedures. But he does have the power overall to do that. So that's not in question. The only question would be, did he go through proper procedure to do it? And I think his lawyer implies that he did. The Justice Department, obviously, at this point at least, thinks he didn't. But like I said, we don't have the evidence yet.
Mm-hmm. Last question here. Could this result in any way in Trump being prevented from running for president again?
There was an argument about that. There is a statute that purports to prevent a president who's charged with a crime and convicted certain kinds of crimes to be ineligible to run for president again. However, the Constitution in Amendment 11 does say that does not say anything about any prohibition against the president running again, period. And if push came to shove, those two laws came to conflict with each other, the Constitution always has supremacy, assuming it's interpreted as we expect it to be interpreted in its normal sense. If that's the case, then Trump could run again.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Mark Clausen is with Cedarville University. Professor, thanks so much for your time and your insight.
Thank you.
Additional support comes from Dort University, offering reimbursed campus visits to show you firsthand how Dort's Christ-centered education leads to lifelong discipleship. Details at dort.edu/visit. From the Issues Etc. podcast, expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. More at issuesetc.org. And from Union Gospel Press, equipping Christians since 1902. Offering award-winning homeschool Bible curriculum and teaching resources. More at UnionGospelPress.com.
An Oregon man is probably wishing he'd thought things through just a bit more. With three warrants issued for his arrest, police were out looking for him. On Sunday, law enforcement finally caught up with him. The man tried to escape, only his choice of getaway vehicle proved a bit of a problem. The suspect attempted to flee in a construction excavator. Video footage shows police walking behind the vehicle as the man tried to escape at 4 or 5 miles per hour. He did manage to drive more than a mile in the slow-moving excavator before finally giving up. Now, Myrna, I'm not exactly sure how this sort of thing happens.
Well, maybe he used the voice-to-text option on his phone. And instead of an escape vehicle, Siri thought he said an excavate vehicle.
Well, perhaps. Regardless of the why, he's definitely dug himself a difficult hole to get out of.
For sure.
It's the world and everything in it.
Today is Thursday, August 18th. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Paul Butler. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, heading back to the moon. Yesterday at the Kennedy Space Center, NASA rolled out the most powerful rocket it's ever built, the Space Launch System. It's the first step in NASA's quest to put humans back on the moon, and beyond that, a larger goal of Mars.
The rocket launch is set for August 29th. The mission is called Artemis 1. World reporter Bonnie Pritchett spoke with some of the people behind the project and brings our story.
So we've got 5 different stations for you, 3 right here, and then a couple of people for you to talk to at Orion. So you've got the Viper team over here. Can't wait to talk to you.
Earlier this month, journalists from around the world swarmed at the Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. They hailed from Poland, Australia, Germany. For many of them, this was a field trip, and they had just been cut loose in outer space wonderland. A guide tried corralling the band of starstruck journalists into NASA's space vehicle mock-up facility.
So you're going to get to see everything, but go ahead and pick a station if you can.
The 3-story hangar is filled with full-scale mock-ups of spacecraft. Vehicles like the Space Shuttle cockpit, Russian Soyuz modules, and Boeing Starliner. The crowning jewel on this tour, the Orion spacecraft. It's different from the Apollo capsule with its tin can gray inverted cone. Orion is bigger and shiny white. Like Apollo, Orion will one day fly humans to the moon and eventually to Mars. But this maiden voyage will be an unmanned 42-day journey around the moon.
And I was actually working in the building with the astronauts when I was here during 1969.
The women and men at various NASA facilities eagerly showcased their role in the Artemis mission. For some, like Andrea Mosey, the thrill never gets old.
Actually, I've been working here for 47 years. I was actually here in 1969 for the Apollo missions because I was a student working here before I went to college. So
Mosey works with NASA's Astromaterials Acquisition and Curation Office. She showed off samples of moon rocks.
But we work in a lab with these moon rocks, and actually we break them, chip them, even bandsaw them, and send them out to the principal investigators who actually does the research study.
Back in the Apollo days, Mosey worked in lunar missions.
It was a lot of excitement. It was so much excitement around the entire Johnson Space Center at that time. I mean, just every morning I would go into my boss's office, and before he got here, and I would look out the window because the astronauts would park in that parking lot. And one mission, I think it was Apollo 12, one had a red Corvette, one had a white Corvette, one had a blue Corvette. So in the morning, they would come in all together, red, white, blue, or...
NASA said it was just promotional. Mosey thought it was exciting.
And that kind of excitement is here now with the Artemis program. Everybody's excited about returning to the moon and to Mars.
Across the room from Mosey is the Orion capsule mock-up. Astronauts will use it to train for Artemis missions.
I'm the Orion spacecraft chief engineer. So I've been with the program. I've been with NASA for 25 years, supporting various programs.
That's Ronnie Backus. His area of expertise is Orion's heat shields. Those shields will protect craft and crew from extreme temperatures when re-entering Earth's atmosphere. But they've only been tested on Earth. The unmanned Artemis 1 mission, scheduled for launch August 29th, will test the shields in actual flight conditions.
But there's certain combinations of heating and aerodynamic pressure all working together that you just cannot duplicate with the ground test. So
a primary objective of the Artemis 1 mission is a performance check of all its systems.
So that we're certifying the system to be safe for putting humans on board for Artemis 2.
Simulations can't predict every potential anomaly. On February 1st, 2003, the shuttle Columbia broke apart upon reentry. Damaged heat shields could not protect the vehicle or its crew. Backus worked on the forensic investigation.
Yes, so I do think of that about that a lot. It's sobering, and it's a reminder of the importance of the job of being diligent as engineers and being open with concerns.
Though sobering, Backus said the Columbia investigation led to greater accountability within NASA and ultimately the continuation of the shuttle program. Once that program ended, NASA returned its gaze to the moon and beyond to Mars. 52 astronauts are vying for crew positions on the next Artemis missions. One of them is Victor Glover. He understands the dangers inherent in human space exploration, as does his family.
So when I got assigned to my mission to the space station, I told my family, NASA's going to get me ready in the next 2 years to go to space, but it's my job to get you ready. And here's the thing is, there's not really a roadmap for that, and so we had to do it together, and it involved a lot of talking, a lot of listening, and a lot of praying together. And so
that preparation, with support from NASA, sustained him and his family during his six-month stay aboard the space station. If selected for an Artemis crew, Glover is confident his family will be ready. He's also confident that Artemis 1 is ready for launch.
We talk about Artemis 1, but Artemis 1 is a stack of hardware and a mission and an idea, but it takes people to make those things happen, and I'm really looking forward to being out there and looking them in the eye and saying, well done, and celebrating with them. The mission is great, but I'm looking to celebrate with the team that made that mission possible.
Reporting for World, I'm Bonnie Pritchett in Houston, Texas.
Thank you.
Today is Thursday, August 18th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Paul Butler. Many public schools across the country have seen an exodus of teachers and students. Cal Thomas joins us now with his thoughts on what might be driving that trend.
As parents prepare to send their children back to school, many will have made decisions about their child's education that will not only put them on a different trajectory, but also impact the public education system, which is being used in too many districts to indoctrinate more than educate. Stories about drag queens in kindergarten, forcing students to use preferred pronouns, biological boys who say they're transgender using locker rooms and showers once reserved for girls, along with a pandemic which convinced growing numbers of parents that homeschooling worked better, all of these are prompting an exodus of parents and now teachers from public schools. The New York Times recently chronicled the trend. Quote, in New York City, the nation's largest school district has lost 50,000 students over the past 2 years. In Michigan, enrollment remains more than 50,000 below pre-pandemic levels from big cities to the rural Upper Peninsula. In the suburbs of Orange County, California, where families have moved for generations to be part of the public school system, enrollment slid for the second consecutive year. Statewide, more than 250,000 public school students have dropped from California's rolls since 2019. End of quote. Not only kids are abandoning public schools, many teachers have also checked out. The Washington Post reports, quote, the teacher shortage in America has hit crisis levels, and school officials everywhere are scrambling to ensure that as students return to classrooms, someone will be there to educate them, unquote. Speaking about the shortage of teachers, Dan Domenech, executive director of the School Superintendent Association, told the Post, I have never seen it this bad. The question is, what kind of classroom will public school kids return to? Will it be like classrooms in Portland, Oregon, where children as young as 5 will be taught transgender ideology, sexual orientation, and the Washington Times reports the role of white colonizers in marginalizing LGBTQ people? Darla Romfo, president of the Children's Scholarship Fund, which offers scholarships to students in poorly performing inner city schools, responds to the sweeping wokeism in an email. She writes, quote, when more than half of students can't even read proficiently, and the pandemic only exacerbated this learning loss, especially for our most vulnerable students, why do schools insist on diverting time and resources into non-academic, controversial subjects that are confusing at best and don't align with many families' values? Parents are tired of it, and rightly so. And my advice is, if your school doesn't respond to your concerns, find another school that will. There are no do-overs when it comes to your child's education, unquote. U.S. students continue to lag behind other countries in reading, math, and science. We appear to be number one, though, in costs, averaging $16,268 per student annually, well above the global average of $10,759. Parents have a right to ask if the cost equals the benefit, since it's their tax dollars. With the proliferation of private schools, more readily available resources for homeschooling, and school choice in growing numbers of states, no wonder more parents are withdrawing their children from public schools. I'm Cal Thomas.
Tomorrow, how might the knowledge that we're made in God's image heal divisions in our country? We'll consider that and more during Culture Friday with Andrew Walker. And the story of a 1940s women's baseball league comes to the small screen. Is it a home run or a strikeout? Colin Garbarino calls balls and strikes. That and more tomorrow. I'm Paul Butler.
And I'm Myrna Brown. The World and Everything in It comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. The Bible says, in this you rejoice, though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith, more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Go now in grace and peace.